In the 18th century, Cape Town had such a luxury and elegance to living that it was even dubbed Little Paris for a time. The Dutch East India Company, or the VOC, built such a thriving colony that it even rivaled some of the richest cities in the West. In particular, the well-to-do wives and daughters of company officials and wealthy burgher elites enjoyed the latest fashions from Europe, the best of Asian-made textiles, diamonds and pearls aplenty, and of course, a bottomless pit of forced labor to painstakingly embroider, bead, and sew it all together. Because economic and social mobility could be so fluid, it was up to these women to compete viciously on the battleground of conspicuous consumption in order to assert and defend their place on the social hierarchy. And yet, these wealthy white settler women, with their almost unending resources, faced their greatest threat from an unexpected minority: the free black women of the Cape. In Tender Ties, Women and the Slave Household, Robert Shell explains.
In 1765, the local authorities took notice of a tiny contingent of the colony's 118 free black women, who, by their dress, placed themselves not only on a par with other respectable burgher wives, but often pushed themselves above them.
So much so that in that same year, sumptuary laws were introduced to control the sartorial exploits of this minority group. Sumptuary laws, for those who aren't aware, are essentially regulations put in place to restrict excessive spending, materialistic extravagance, especially with regards to clothing, furniture, and food. On the surface, they're supposedly rooted in Christian ideals of modesty and to curtail sins of pride, envy, and greed. But most often, they're about ensuring that the wealthy and the elite can visually distinguish themselves from the lower classes. The Dutch Empire, from what is now present-day Indonesia to South Africa, kind of shot themselves in the foot with this. As you'd expect, invading foreign countries and stealing their resources greatly advances the prosperity of a society, and a lot of these settlers who would have been poor and destitute in their home country could now enjoy a life of extreme luxury in any of the Dutch colonies. I think that's actually the one instance where trickle-down economics actually works. So sumptuary laws weren't a new concept to the Cape Colony and were first introduced to curtail the expenditure and flexing of the Dutch themselves. There were a litany of rules about how many pearls you could wear according to your husband or father's rank in the company, limits on parasols in a square mile, how big a silk train you could have on your dresses, and even whether you could wear silver or gold-buckled shoes. But what's most interesting for me is that in a world with very little visual representation of non-white people of this time, particularly non-white women, that the sumptuary laws placed upon free black women of the Cape actually reveal a lot to us about their lives and tastes. Though before we can discuss some of these specifics, we need to get into the complicated definition of race in the Cape of Good Hope. Somewhat confusingly, black in this context isn't limited to just people of African descent. In fact, the main requirement to be considered white or European was being Christian and/or from Holland. The enslaved population was made up of several people of Asian and African descent, including people trafficked from India, Malaysia, China, Angola, Mozambique, Madagascar, also including convicts and political prisoners from various East Asian states brought here to serve prison sentences by working the land, for example. The actual people from the Cape, like the Khoi, were technically not considered as slaves, but they lived in such extreme indentured servitude that they were enslaved in almost every aspect but name. However, a small portion of enslaved people could be granted manumission, which is like emancipation from slavery, except it only applies to a select few who often receive this through either acquiring favor with slaveholders, completing a prison sentence, or having their freedom purchased by someone else. And a lot of these people, along with the enslaved population, would grow to make up the ancestors of the Cape Coloured community today. And some of them, through becoming Christians or through marriage, would become what we consider white people today. But that's getting ahead of the period at hand. The free blacks were a very small part of the colony's population, and many of them were based in Cape Town, able to come into fortune and social mobility through becoming traders, merchants, fishermen, and so forth. And business was good enough that these people could adorn the women of their community in fashions luxurious enough to get the Cape authorities upset. Robert Shell goes on to explain the sumptuary laws as such.
The all-male political council, perhaps prompted by settler women, deemed such behavior unseemly and vexing to the public. Henceforth, no free black women were to appear in public in coloured silk clothing, hoop skirts, fine laces, adorned bonnets, curled hair, or even earrings.
Emancipated female slaves in everyday aspect were ordered to wear no other material but chintz and striped cotton. The only exception was that those of good character were permitted black silk dresses for marriages, when they were witnesses at a baptism, or when for some other reason they went to church. You might understand why this was a problem, because it becomes very difficult to assert that white is right when black looks so good. But once again, I think this is an instance of the VOC digging their own graves. Enslaved people were as much a status symbol for colonialists in the same way a large mansion or a gilded carriage could be. After all, they're products, not people, right? In order to demonstrate the wealth of their slaveholders, enslaved servants would be decked in gold and silver jewelry, or even given expensive uniforms like livery to wear, while they followed these VOC elite women through the streets. The showing off got so out of hand that sumptuary laws were introduced for how grand this could be, which included limits on who could bestow jewels on their workers and what kind of jewels, or even how many enslaved people you could have following you in public. Lower-ranking merchants and VOC members could only dress the enslaved in red or blue linen, and if necessary, wool, as long as it was totally plain. Also, as an aside, because clothing was such an important part of indicating identity and rank, it also had the unintended effect of allowing some people to liberate themselves. Like I said, Khoi people weren't technically enslaved. And supposedly one of the ways you could identify a Khoi person from, say, an Angolan or Mozambican person would be the absence of shoes. And it appears that sometimes enslaved people could pass themselves off as being Khoi through their dress and eventually travel around the colony without being apprehended. But also, it seems that one of the first things newly free people would acquire were shoes. It's a bit unclear, but it also seems that some people also kept enslaved people specifically barefoot as a way to indicate their position. And it also appears that sometimes through just acquiring or even stealing a good pair of shoes and a hat, you could fashion yourself into looking like one of the free blacks. This became such a problem that in 1774, the first version of the dompas would be introduced in order to help officials in better identifying runaways. I just think that's painfully funny, but once again goes to show the power of fashion. And anyway, I'm highlighting this existing nature between clothing and slavery because I think it offers us some insight into how these free black women may have developed such opulent tastes. Though, in all honesty, I think that they could have done anything and run into some of the same issues. Like, it's very reminiscent of the Tignon laws in the Caribbean, where because women of African descent were so enticing and tempting in the beautiful ways they styled their natural hair, that they would become forced to wear head wraps. And of course, they got so creative with those that became a problem as well. But another aspect that I think also influenced why and how these women in the Cape Colony were so stylish also had to do with the same reason why some of them were brought over here in the first place. Remember how I mentioned that the VOC and burger elite women were so up to date with trends that even visitors and travelers couldn't distinguish between them and upper class women in France? Well, this was all possible because of enslaved labor. A lot of the women brought over from Malaysia, India, and Indonesia were specifically sought after because of their skills in dressmaking and needlecraft. Obi Menzel, a traveling writer, says of the enslaved women in the 1730s,
"The slave women from Bengal, Surata, and other places can work and embroider most beautifully, so long as the designs are provided for them. These slaves are for this reason very valuable, and a housewife who possesses any of them keeps them employed upon work of this kind the whole year long."
Another traveling writer, John Barrow, wrote of the Cape women in the 1790s,
"They are expert at the needle, at all kinds of lace, knotting, and tambour work, and in general make up their own dresses, following the prevailing fashions of England, brought from time to time by the female passengers bound to India."
So I've been researching Shwe Shwe for the next episode, and a thing that keeps coming up is how great an influence places like India and Indonesia had on global textile production. The absolute quality and skill and innovation and creativity was dying, weaving, printing, and embroidery and so forth was so incredibly influential, not just in Europe, but Africa and the Americas. And I imagine that a lot of these free black women would have been carrying these rich textile traditions into their newly emancipated lives. Actually, when I visited the slave lodge here in Cape Town, this was kind of confirmed to me by how many instances there were of these women working as seamstresses and milliners following the end of slavery. And what I like about this is that any so-called ostentatious displays by them wasn't just about looking rich or showing off or being materialistic, but perhaps a chance to assert their dignity and connect with their community through reaching into centuries-old practices and traditions passed down through generations, essentially fashioning their humanity in the way they best knew. It's just a bonus that it also happened to upset their oppressors. Thanks so much for spending this time with me. This was a very unplanned episode. Like I mentioned before, I've been hard at work on the Shweshwe episode, which will hopefully be out before the end of this month, where we're going to go quite deep into the history and evolution of the so-called denim of South Africa. It's an evolution that touches so many parts of the world, from its origins in East Asia to how it connects to indigenous African traditions, along with how Europeans capitalized on it, to how it's now become such an integral part of cultural identity in Southern Africa. So in short to say, it's a lot of reading and research to get through, but that will be coming up soon. In the meantime, I've just recently launched a Patreon. If you are interested in financially supporting the show, membership starts as little as $1 and goes up to $15, and you will get access to all of my research notes and references and readings, along with some visual references if that's of interest to you. You'll also get behind the scenes content and bonus content, such as full length interviews from the show, such as all of the amazing conversations we had for the embroidery and apartheid episode, along with some fun prizes and little special surprises to come up soon. I'm still planning all those out. But if you are interested, you can sign up today. The link will be in the show notes. If you are not interested in a monthly subscription, you can also make a once-off donation to my Buy Me a Coffee account, which will also be linked below. But you are obviously in no obligation to provide any sort of financial support. Subscribing to the podcast, sharing it, telling your friends, leaving a review, rating the show are all really helpful and much appreciated. If you'd like, you can keep up with me on Instagram and TikTok, where I am at OKBuddyK. I also publish a weekly Substack newsletter called Hanger Management. Again, everything will be linked below, and we will catch you next time. Peace out.